Take it away.
A nice voice. You hear that recording in progress? I don't know if everybody heard that. Morning, everybody. My name is Roger. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm happy to be here. I don't get to many of these Sunday morning meetings. One of the benefits, one of the gifts of sobriety is my wife and I have found that we really enjoy our Sunday mornings. And we're still old-fashioned folks. We read the paper, the actual paper on we have a nice breakfast and we'll watch some news shows or go for a walk or whatever. So that's why you never see me on Sundays. But when Jimmy asked, of course I said yes. This is well, a couple of things. I just take a second just to thank Jimmy. I mean, he does a remarkable job with all of this, with everything he does to help this group. And God, I love this group. I know we all do. This is just from the beginning of COVID till now. And the thanks can go on and on for Mark and everything that he does for us. It's a beautiful thing. And I'm sure he can tell you, he'll probably post it as soon as I say it. I think this is meeting 1642 or something. He knows how many meetings we've had. And this has been a wonderful, wonderful thing. Tom, the website looks great. And Marty, I can't tell you how wonderful it is to see you smile without that hose and everything else. It's just it's been a long road, my friend. You're an inspiration to all of us. You say yes when people ask you in AA, and we all say it, and it sometimes sounds a little trite or overused, I guess, but what wouldn't you do for AA? Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, saved our lives, and it sounds overblown and exaggerated and hyperbole and all that stuff, but it certainly saved my marriage, saved my career, saved my health. Looking back on it and where I was headed, it's not an exaggeration to say it saved my life. And thank God for this. Thank God for everything we've got here. Starting out the usual routine, I'm a member of the How It Works men's group. Saturday morning, 7:30, get 100 guys. So those of you in Western New York, I'm sure you're familiar with our group, and many of you go there. It's a special place. I remember hearing early on, if you don't think your home group is the best home group in the world, either do something to work hard and help your home group get better, or find a new home group. But I love my home group. And my sobriety date is January 5th, 1989. I have a sponsor. Dave P is my sponsor. He's been my sponsor for decades. Dave has a sponsor. His sponsor's original sponsor, Tom B, when Tom passed away, didn't take Dave very long to get another sponsor, John P. And I sponsor some guys, and the guys I sponsor guys, and there's an elegance to that I just like. I like what we do. Just a little about my family and my drinking, what I was like. My parents were, I'm the only child my parents ever had, and I know Mark's an only child, and some others are. It's a blessing and a curse, as I often say, and that kind of summarized it for me. You get lots of attention, which is a nice thing, but it also nurtures the selfishness in the alcoholic. Not that I needed any nurturing, but had that part. But the other part of it is, when you're an only child, you learn about loneliness. And when I got near the end of my drinking, boy, did I get face to face with loneliness. And that beginning of A Vision for You, when he talks about the chilling vapor that's loneliness settled down and becoming ever darker and blacker, however he puts that. That whenever I hear that, it's just so just hits me in the gut, because I, like so many of us, I experienced that at the end. But I, my parents were good people, hardworking people, drinkers. My mother and father, when I remember growing up, when people came over, and you had company, you handed them a drink. And then you handed them another one. And everybody who was came to the house had a drink, one after another until they left. And I don't remember my parents ever serving an adult iced tea or lemonade, or once in a while one of the ladies would have a glass of ginger ale. But I learned that the drinking was just drinking, and my dad was, although he never diagnosed himself, we have a self-diagnosed disease here, but he certainly looked like an alcoholic. He was a binger, and I felt sorry for him. That's a tough spot to be, when you can control it once in a while, and then other times you can't. He would have loved this program. But I, we talk about, you often hear people t say that, oh, I've never felt like I fit in. I didn't feel good enough. I felt separate, apart from, different, all the different ways that we describe, this experience of alcoholism and how you feel. And, Dr. Silkworth describes it well as restless, irritable, and discontented. I've never heard a better description. That's how I was. That's how I felt most of my life. And I didn't know I didn't feel good, but I didn't feel good. I didn't feel good. And like so many of us, I was 14. Some of the guys in the neighborhood got together, got some beers, and so I was in the fields, near the trees, near the town park where I lived, and I probably had three, four beers that night, that first night, and I just loved it. I loved it. It was magic, and you know what I mean. I mean, it was the first time in my life that I ever felt as good as other people looked like they felt. That oh, okay, I'm finally here. I finally belong, it felt like, and I don't know, that's probably an illusion, but that's what it felt like. And I loved it, and I chased it. I chased it. That first summer, I was originally just a hanger on, hoping to get the call. And after a while, I became the ringleader, making sure we had beers. And this is, Chuck's on the screen. He likes his part. Hi. Other than rainy days, because we drank outside. I mean, we were kids, right? So, other than rainy days, we drank every night that summer, and there was only one that we voluntarily missed. It was the television show, if you remember the old TV show, The Fugitive, with David Janssen. The last episode was airing on that last one of the last Saturdays, or I don't remember what day it was, but it was in August, and end of August, and the you're finally going to find out who the one-armed man is, and or who's going to catch the one-armed man, and all the story was going to resolve. And we all stayed home that day. We didn't drink. We stayed home and watched that, because we didn't have VCRs or no way to record TV. So if you missed it, you missed it. But that summer was the beginning of the end of my social drinking. That fall, I got back to school. One of my buddies met this girl, and we went over to her house, and some girlfriends, and her they had a flat upstairs that was vacant, and so we all went up there to party a little bit. And Mary Jane, I remember her, blonde, pretty girl. Mary Jane's brother bought us some booze. We got gin and rum, as I recall. And up until that point, all I drank was beer. So you know how you drink beer quickly. And so that night I had I don't know, about half of the gin and half of the rum, whatever we had. I had more than my share in a half an hour. I drank it real fast, and I got really drunk. I mean, really drunk. And it wasn't even dark out yet, and these guys are sending me home. They put me on a bus, and I remember my mother opened the door, and I fell in the hallway, and I stood up in the kitchen, and I fell backwards, and when I woke up Saturday, this was a Friday night. I woke up on Saturday, and there's puke all over the pillowcase, and I was sicker than I'd ever been, and I didn't feel better until Sunday night. I mean, it was horrible. And I remember consciously saying this. It was like it was yesterday. I remember, I'm never doing this again, man. This is not worth it. I am not going to do this anymore. And I was drunk a couple weekends later. And that was it. That's my story. I mean, it's just there's other parts to it, but that's the essence of it. I was starting to lose the ability to control how much I drank. And if I let myself, well, I didn't really have any control, but there were days that I would drink and I would have a few and behave like a normal guy and go home. And there were other times I just couldn't find that shutoff switch. I just kept drinking. And I was in high school. I went to a all boys Catholic high school, and we had a lot of fun. And we were drinking before the dances and the football games, and we started smoking some weed. And we weren't really getting in a lot of trouble, but it was I had a lot of fun. And I went to college locally and finished in 4 years, which I guess a lot of kids don't do these days, but we all did. We finished in 4 years, and I had three jobs. I worked in a shoe store. I was selling shoes at a strip plaza that had a shoe store in it, and I worked in a bar. A buddy of mine's dad owned a fish fry bar, Buffalo Institution. They're busy on Friday and Saturday nights. So Saturday and Sunday mornings, I would go in and I'd clean the restrooms, do the floors, put the empties away, refill the coolers, all the stuff like that. And I worked in a bakery. I worked in a mass production bakery. I was listening to Jim talk about mixing the pizza dough. I worked at regional bakeries around the country. There was a location in Buffalo where we made Wonder Bread and Hostess cakes. I mean, Ho-Ho's and Twinkies and cupcakes and all that stuff. And bakers work out hours. I had my main shift was 11 to 7, and there were other, sometimes you start at 3 in the morning, or it's horrible hours, just to be able to get the product out the door. And given those hours, by the time I was 19 or 20 when I was doing this, I was a daily drinker and daily drug user, weed smoker at that time. By the time I was 20, I'd go to work, and sometimes I'd be still a little drunk, often a little higher, a little more than high, certainly hungover. And one night, one of my jobs was that one summer I was a mixer, and I'd mix a 500-pound bowl of cake batter every 11 minutes, and it would get sucked in the machinery, and then bake the cupcakes and stuff. And all of a sudden, I was there probably just an hour into the shift, and the alarm's going off, and the supervisor's running around screaming, "What the hell did you do?" And all the cake was coming out flat, and they had to throw out the whole batch. I forgot to put in the baking powder. And instead of learning what normal people would do is you don't drink or get high before you go to work, I put a sign in the mixer that said, "Don't forget the baking powder." That's how we are. We're resourceful, resilient folks, and that's how I was. But I did well in school. I got out, and it was, work hard, play hard, the kind of things that we all describe ourselves. But a daily drug user, and the disease was progressing. And I got married young. I was 22, which I guess is young. Feels young, considering I didn't start growing up till I was 36. Still haven't finished. 22 was young, and I was young. And but I married Charlotte. Many of you know her. Love of my life, wonderful woman, a blessing beyond my due for sure. But when we got married, her dad owned a liquor store, and people would tease me that that's why I married her. But that's kind of silly, but the thing I noticed right away is that these people, this family, didn't drink like my family. They didn't drink like I did, for sure. My father-in-law John, he had a liquor cabinet in the family room, and the only thing that was in there was stuff that he couldn't sell in the store. And they didn't drink. Every now and then somebody would have a tummy ache, and they'd have some blackberry brandy or something, but they didn't drink like I drank. And I remember, it's sort of old fashioned. I didn't live live with my wife before we got married. So we're living together for a few months after we were married, and she looked at me one day and she says, "Don't you ever drink soda or juice or water?" I said, "No, I'm an adult man. I drink adult beverages." And I was trying to convince her that the way I lived, the way I drank, was normal, which of course it wasn't. And she's, the just lots of incidents, and I'll spare you all the silly details, but the main part of it is that I left her alone. I was a guy ran around. I was out drinking and carousing and just wasn't home a lot. And she did not sign up for that, but that's what she got. She's got lots of stories. As early on, I think I was mid 20s, we were only married a year or so. I fancy myself as sort of a cook. I'm not a cook. I'm not a Jimmy for sure. I can make three or four things, but anyway. So I mean, I was having people over for dinner. We had these people coming over, and I was cooking all day and drinking all day, as we do. And I got the first course on the table, and in the back of that apartment, we had an extra bedroom with a couch. And I just got up from the table and kind of moseyed back there and went on the couch and passed out. Room full of people, house full of people, food on the stove. I was done, And my wife can tell lots of stories like that, things that I embarrassed her. It's just, or she'd be looking outside and there's the car. Where's the car? Oh, the car's in the driveway. Okay, where the hell is he? Looking all over, couldn't find me. Opens up the door and I'm passed out asleep on the front step, at the keys in my hand. I almost made it, but I just couldn't quite make it. So, it's a progressive disease. It's a progressive disease, and it kept getting worse. I kept drinking more and more and using more and more. I don't talk about drugs that much in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did lots of drugs, and it kept getting worse. And I kept losing more and more control. And well, you know what it's like. I mean, my life got very small, very, very small. I had all I wanted to do was drink and get high. I didn't care about my marriage, relationships, family. I didn't care about my career, work, or whatever. All that stuff, I was just doing enough to get by and trying to hold it together. But really, it was just leave me alone. I just want to drink and get high. I don't want to do anything else. And you know what that's like. You talk about loneliness. You can't tell anybody the truth about how you're living. I couldn't. The deal of you get to work in the morning and somebody says, "Hey, how you doing?" You say, "Oh, I'm doing okay." And what you really want to say is, "Well, I know it's February and it's cold out, but I spent half the night in the garage, went back and forth about three or four times in my underwear to take a swig of whiskey so I could get back to sleep." And you come in with that, you got 3 hours of sleep, and you're nasty, and that was me. And it just progressed, and it got to the point where, we always get, there's a point for us, and there was a point for me. I was not a binger. Mostly I was a daily drinker, but I went on a 5 day binge that was the binge to beat all binges, I guess. I just totally lost control and drinking and drugs and stuff. And I got to work that after that weekend, and one of my partners, I was working on something with her, and I told her I was going to do something over the weekend. And so we were working on a project together, and this was my part, and I was supposed to do it. And she came in that day and said, "Did you finish what we talked about?" And of course, I didn't. I completely forgot about it, and I just said, "I forgot. I forgot." And she started yelling at me, and like most alcoholics, I don't like to be yelled at. And I started yelling back at her. I says, and I don't know where this came from, but I just said, "You don't know what it's like for me. You don't know what my life is like, And she said, "Well, why don't you tell me what your life is like?" And I said, "Well, I don't know where these words came from. I've never said them before about me or anybody else, but I said, I think I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict." And she said, "Are you asking for help?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." And she said, "It's about time." And they all knew there was something wrong with me. Surprisingly, a lot of them didn't know it was alcohol and drugs, but they knew there was something very wrong with me. I mean, some days I'd be Mr. Cheerful, and other days you'd say good morning to me and I'd bite your head off, and Or I disappear for a couple of days, leave for a meeting out of the office on a Tuesday, and nobody saw me until Thursday. And it's like my wife didn't know where I was. And I remember that. I remember he was sitting in the boss's office, and he has a yellow pad in front of him, and he's saying, "Where the hell were you?" And no answer. I had no answer, and it was it's a sweet moment in my memory. They made some calls. I don't remember the sequence, but eventually I landed up in detox. And it was the first time in my life, you go in there and doctor examines you, and he said, "Did you drink today?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, you knew you were coming to the hospital to get detoxed, and so why did you drink today?" "I don't know. I didn't know." And they sent a counselor in, and it was the first time in my life I ever told anybody the truth. I told this guy the truth. I told him how much I drank. I told him what I drank. I told him all the drugs I used. He looked at me and he says, "So you do all that shit all together?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "You're lucky you're not dead." And that's, of course, was the truth. And he said to me, he said, "Well, we'll just let the doctors take care of you for a while. I'll be down in a few days. Talk to you." And that first day, I remember they wanted to give me Librium, and I said, "I don't want any of that shit. I came here to get clean." I was one of the things I did. I did a lot of cocaine at the end, and if you do a lot of cocaine, you need a lot of Valium, and I had this big jug of 10 milligram Valium, the blue V's I used to call them. And they're offering me Librium, and I'm saying, no, I don't want that. And after the second day, I was shaking. I was begging for it, and I was walking around. I had my IV pole, for about, I don't know, 4 days or so, 4 or 5 days. The that same counselor came down. The guy took the intake interview, and he said to me, he said, "Well, I just want to tell you about the treatment program we have." He said, "We're going to take you up to the fourth floor where our rehab is, and just give you a little idea what that program is like." And I just said, whoa, wait a minute, wait a minute. I said, I don't need rehab. I'm not that bad." I said, this is way over the, this is overblown. I said, "I know I overshot the mark, but I think I know what I'm doing. I think I just need to, how do I get out of here?" And he looked at me and he smiled, and he said, "Look," he says, "I don't know you." He says, I talked to you for 20 minutes the other day." And he says, "Fancy guy like you with your ass hanging out of your nightgown and your paper slippers." He says, "Let me tell you what I see." He goes, you are a people-pleasing, procrastinating perfectionist. You're an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. You're a loner. You feel like a loser. And you're way, way too proud to ask anybody for help because you know everything. And if you can't figure it out yourself, it's not worth asking anybody." And he said, "And right now, more than anything," he says, "you want to have a drink." And I looked at him and I said, "Bingo." "How'd you know?" And he said to me, "Well," he says, I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about me." He says, "You just nodded in all the right places." And he, and I, there's all these CACs that work in these places in the rehabs, are credentialed or certified or whatever. I think it's credentialed alcoholism counselors. And these are good people, big-hearted people who want to help people. And they go into social work, and they want to help alcoholics, and they help a lot of people. And I'm not putting them down. They helped me. But this guy, this particular counselor, was sober 12 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said to me, he says, "Look," he says, "I'm going to tell you the truth here." He says, "At least the way I see it." And he says, "And I hope you listen to me." He says, "There's no treatment for this disease. We call this a treatment program." He says, "But 28 days, we're going to give you some vitamins and make you pee in a cup and make sure nobody brings anything into you. But you're going to get out of here, and you'll be separated from your knucklehead friends and from your environment for a month, and you'll be cleaned up, and you'll maybe look a little better." He says, "But you're going to be just as nuts as you were when you got here." He says, "We can't fix you." And he said, "But After you're in the unit for a few days, he said, "We're going to take you out in that blue van you saw in the parking lot, the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the community." And he says, "And if you have any hope of living a decent life," he says, "you're going to find something at those meetings that you can hang on to. Because otherwise," he says, "you don't have much of a chance." And I don't know why I heard the guy, but I heard the guy. I listened to him. And when I went to the meetings, they took us out in the meetings. I liked the meetings. I was attracted to you, to us. When I heard people talking, it was the first time in my life I ever heard people saying things that I had felt my whole life, but never been able to put words to about, being afraid and lying all the time and telling yourself you're not going to drink and then drinking and all of the things that you couldn't tell anybody. People in these meetings were saying these things, and I'm nodding my head, going, "Yeah, that's me," And I had some hope. I had some hope, and I got out after the 28 days ended, and my wife picked me up. She was barely talking to me at the time, but she did pick me up, brought me home, and it was February, and it snowed that day, and she said to me, "Well, why don't you make yourself useful and shovel the driveway?" And she said, "I'm going to the store." So she was going to Wegmans, go to this grocery store. And I had to shovel the driveway because, like any good self-respecting alcoholic, we had a snowblower that had been broken for 3 years. I couldn't get around to fixing it. But I made a big show before I went into rehab of throwing out. I remember the day she was taking me. I had all my hiding places. I had the bottles and I had the bong and the straws and the blades and the mirrors. I hit everything on the table. I'm changing my life. This is it. It's all different. But I didn't really throw out everything. And that first day I was home, I'm in the garage. She left, and I remember there was a bottle of vodka behind the workbench, and I looked at it and I had it in my hand, and it scared the shit out of me. I mean, I was literally shaking. That's because, like, I all spent 6 days in detox and 28 days in rehab, and I had my big book and my 24-hour book and my schedule, and I'm changing my life, and this is going to be different. And I'm home 10 minutes, and I got a drink in my hand, and it's like, holy shit! And it was like a 2x4 hit me in the head. This powerless over alcohol, I got it. That moment, I was blessed with that understanding at depth that I am powerless over alcohol. And the I did what they told us to do. I called somebody, old timer. There was this buddy of mine, Dan, who got out of rehab 2 weeks before me. He was the only guy who went AA, and he told me, he said, "Okay," he says, "let's." This is before we had cordless phones in the house. He goes, "You got a cord on that phone? A long cord?" Yeah. He says, "Let me." He said, "Go to the sink, open up, pour out the vodka. Rinse the bottle, spill it." He says, "You got any weed?" I go, "Yeah." I go, "Okay, throw it in the toilet. Let me hear it flush." "Okay, flush it again, because I know there's some shit floating around. You're going to pick it out and dry it out and try to smoke it later." He says, "Let's just get rid of everything." And he says, "And I'll pick you up at 7 o'clock, and we're going to a meeting." And I was scared. I was just scared of going back to living the way I was living. I was confused and bewildered, and all the stuff that we say, just totally baffled. And but I got up that next morning, and I remember they said, "You got to ask God for a sober day." And I didn't it didn't make sense to me. And we all have old ideas. We all of They're all different, but most of us have old ideas. And I had an old idea, and I could not ask God to help me. I had squandered every gift he ever gave me. God was mad at me. I can't, if my getting better is going to rely on God helping me, I'm screwed. But I was afraid not to do it. So I got on my knees, and it felt strange. I didn't think the words were going past the ceiling. I didn't feel any connection. I didn't feel anything, but I asked God for a sober day, and thanked him that night and started going to the meetings. And I still had this hang up, this second step, coming to believe I can't ask God to help me. And if you remember, I like speaker meetings. We're here at a speaker meeting. Every now and then I like to hear somebody's whole story. And the old days, we used to, I don't know if anybody remembers the Tape of the Month Club from Dykolb in Bellevue, Nebraska. I used to get these cassettes, and you'd put them in the cassette deck in the car, and you'd ride around and listen to speakers. And I remember this woman, Jane. There was something about her and the way she talked, and she just said, you know, God is bigger than any pain, any hurt that you have. He meets you way down in the pit, right where you are. You don't have to get good before you go to God. Just come to him, just the way you are, and ask him to help you. And one of my old ideas was this arrogant idea that I had to fix myself. I had to make myself good. I had to make myself better. I couldn't go to God unless I was better. And somehow I must have heard it 20 times at the meetings, but I heard this woman. I heard her, you know, go to God just the way you are and ask him for help. And then things changed. I don't know how else to say it, but things changed. I started becoming active, and you don't know when it happens, but it happened. The obsession to drink was removed. And, you know, I'm sort of on my way on the path to recovery, right? And, you know, this is not, certainly not linear what we do here. I was doing good, and I remember I was probably a couple of years sober, and I was going to buddy of mine, a guy that I knew from rehab, was getting a anniversary medallion, and he asked me to come and give it to him. And it was at the Loop Port Group in Lewis, and I remember going up there, and for the last, I don't know, week or so before that meeting, I was just feeling lousy. I was down in the dumps, and I was depressed and sad and hopeless, and just couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. And I went to that meeting, and I, you know, had a great time, lots of fellowship, and I said nice things about this guy, and he said nice things about me, and oh, it was a great night. And I'm driving home, and I'm going over the Grand Island Bridge, and got tears running down my face. And all I could think about was I wanted to stop the car at the top of the bridge and just jump off. I just couldn't take it anymore. And I got home, and I remember the next morning I called Dave, my sponsor, and I said, told him what happened. And he says, Roger, he says, you know, he said, you're not failing AA. I know. Just because you don't feel good right now, you're not doing it wrong. And he said, you know, when we pray, he says, I think the answer to your prayer right now is go to the doctor. And went to the doctor, and I was prescribed antidepressant medication. And you know, there were some people at the table saying, you know, you've taken medicine, you're cheating, you're not sober, you shouldn't take that stuff. And I get mad at that these days. That's just sort of an editorial comment. You know, I ask people, if I ever hear say anybody say that at a table these days, you know, I say, you know, where did you go to medical school? Where was your psychiatry residency? You know, I get turned into a wise ass, but I mean, I know there are people who abuse, you know, Klonopin and Xanax, and people who smoke weed and think they're sober. I know there's things that you shouldn't do, but my feeling is if a doctor prescribes an SSRI for you so that you're not jumping off bridges, maybe that's not such a bad thing. But anyway, just an aside. But I'm going along, and you know, my wife, I remember that I was sober about a year, and my wife says to me, she says, "This is great." She says, "You're sober." She goes, "You're out every fucking night, just like before." And I heard her, and it was like, start looking for some daytime meetings. And here in Western New York, we got this eye-opener group. I'm sure they have one in a lot of communities. 7:30 in the morning, 7 days a week. And I started going to that meeting, and for the first, I was probably about a year sober when this happened. Next 4 years, I went to that meeting like almost every day, and it saved my ass. It just saved my ass. The regularity of people who got to know you, and they could call you on your bullshit. And these are people that are working the steps. And I got a sponsor, and he said to me, "How you doing on these steps?" And I said, "I'm not, you know." So he said, "All right, well, you're going to take a shot at these steps," because he said it politely but sarcastically. He says, "You're in a 12-step recovery program. It's kind of dumb to be in a 12-step program. You don't do the 12 steps. So let's do the steps, you know." So we got on our knees in his office, and I said the third step prayer with him. And before I left, he handed me a yellow pad and a pencil. And he said, okay, you're looking at the book. He says, our decision will have little permanent effect or whatever, unless at once followed by this idea of looking at yourself and getting down to causes and conditions and all that stuff. And he says, you got to write your inventory. And I did that. I started doing the deal. I started doing what we do. I remember being desperate enough that I said, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, man. I'll do whatever you say. I just want to be, I don't want to feel like this anymore. And I started recovering. I started getting better. So one day after, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I'm at this eye-opener group, and this pretty young lady starts making eyes at me, and I start making eyes at her, and one thing leads to another, and I left my wife of 20 years to move in with this newcomer that I met at the beginner's table. She was 26, I was 41. The arithmetic seemed to work. She had a 6-month-old baby boy. The father of that baby died a couple months before the baby was born. It was just, oh my God, get on your white horse, Roger, go in and rescue and save this situation. And you can imagine how well that worked out. I think we were together about 2 months, 3 months. I had signed a 1-year lease. I remember that year. It was 1994. I was paying for her rent. I was paying for my wife's mortgage. I was paying for my rent. And I ate a lot of macaroni and cheese and Cheerios. That was my high carb year. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot about selfishness, and I hurt my wife. I hurt my wife deeply. And it was the dishonesty, the selfishness, and I hurt that woman too, that young woman that I was with. It was just, I learned some things that were very, very hard for me to learn, it's like, well, if you're married, be married. You want to run around and chase girls, don't be married. Don't wear a sign on your neck that says you're available when you're not available. It's a good idea to get out of one relationship before you get in the next one. A lot of us try to audition number two before we're finished with number one, and that works for some people, but it didn't work for me. I learned a lot, and it took us a long time. My wife and I were separated for 3 years. She was After a couple months, I decided I don't want to be with anybody else. I want to be with her, and she had enough brains to say, oh, not so fast, buddy. You're not. She did not open the door and say, come right in. So we worked on stuff for about 3 years or so before we got back together. But I remember she, we were eating, I guess. I don't know. We're doing stuff. Oh, I know. I ran into a friend of mine, a guy I hadn't seen in a few years and everything. He says, so what's going on? He says, you guys getting a divorce? Are you moving back in? You're reconciling? What's going on? And I said, well, I said, we got some, we've worked through a lot of things. Things are going really good, but I think we need some, there's a couple issues we have left. We need some couples counseling. And he says, so, well, why aren't you doing it? And I said, well, Charlotte doesn't seem to be very interested in it. And I said, she didn't have as good a time in therapy as I did. She doesn't like therapists or counselors and stuff. And he says, so what you're saying is, he says, you are deciding what the two of you need. He says, you're a bully. He says, why don't you listen to her? She's telling you she doesn't want to do this. She doesn't want to do this. And I went and I told her, I said, I said, maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe we don't need any couples counseling. Maybe we can work out the last few issues we have together by ourselves. And her shoulders relaxed, her expression on her face changed, and it smiled. And it was just like, he's finally freaking listening to me. It's about time this guy's listening. I moved back in, and it's been good. It's been real good. There's been a lot of growing pains, but we've done well. And I'm moving along, and I remember that we have spiritual weekends, those men's retreats. I was working on that committee, and I was active in a home group, and I'm sponsoring guys, and I'm going along. Everything's good, growing in recovery, working hard at work, and things are going along. And I think it was probably about 13 years sober, and I hit a wall. And a lot of you know what I mean, this emotional bottom, or I don't know. I was just beside myself. Nothing made sense. Is this all there is? I was just feeling at a loss. And lo and behold, don't I find myself, there's some woman I met through a work thing. All of a sudden I fell in love again. Oh my God, here it is again. And naturally, the experience I had, I went and talked to my sponsor. He said, well, I don't know if you learned anything the last time, but it didn't work out so well for you this time. He says, you better get honest with yourself, man. And I had been, I told that once before, getting honest with myself about my drinking. And I did, and that worked out. And I don't know, one thing led to another. There was a friend of mine, a woman that I knew for years, and her name was Charmaine. She was a wonderful woman. And she said to me, she says, we better have coffee. Well, yeah, I want to talk to you. And sat down, and she looked at me and she said, darling, she called everybody darling. She goes, darling, she says, you're so in love with your story. You just, it's so hard for you. You just feel these feelings. And she says, and let me tell you what I see. She says, I hear you at tables. I've been at tables with you, and you talk about the emptiness that you feel, and you say that it's a God-shaped hole, and that the only thing that can fill it is a relationship with God. I've heard you say it. And she said, and you're not living it. She says, you fill it with things, with achievements, within relationships, and all that stuff, because she said the only thing that's going to fill that emptiness is improving your relationship with God. Now, my sponsor up until that point had told me, whenever I was having problem du jour, he says, what you need is more spiritual development. I mean, the message was clear. But she taught me a prayer. She says, and I'm sure a lot of you know this prayer. It's this, God, give me the power to put my relationship with you before everything else in my life. Take me to a place where I'm gladly ready to have nothing be more important to me than having a better relationship with you. Please heal all my old ideas and restore me to sanity. Dear God, please reveal yourself to me. And I said that prayer a lot. I talk about Charmaine met me for coffee. This was not a fast thing. We met for coffee every couple of weeks for a year or more before that crap got into my head. But eventually I straightened out. It was like, I can't rely on anything outside of myself to make me feel better. It really is. It's a God deal, and it's an inside job. And all the things I've been hearing all those years, it finally made sense to me. And it was clear that I needed God's help with everything, not only with drinking, using and not using, but everything, and overcoming my fear and overcoming my selfishness and dealing with my bouts of anger. And I need God's help with everything. And, things got better. I don't know how else to say, but things got better. Continued to be an active sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept asking, that was my prayer every day. Lord, help me to be an active and sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, sponsoring guys and things going well. And just to get to finishing up, the pandemic came, right? We had COVID, and this deal started. What a blessing this has been, this thing. And I retired about 5.5 years ago. There's a church around the corner. It was an Episcopal church. They used to have a congregation. And they'd rent it to, like most Protestant churches, they'd rent space to AA meetings. And the congregation shrunk, and they eventually closed the church, but it became a recovery center. They call it the Hope Center. They have AA and Al-Anon and ACOA and GA and SA. And it's just, they probably have, I don't know, 30 meetings a week, something like that. I started going to that meeting, and I got active and involved again. And I started doing some things I had always wanted to do and never been able to do. I was going out to the rehabs, and I started going to Stutzman and local rehab place here in Clearview, and went up to ECMC, and when they had the rehab and the detox there. And from our home group, we go to the Salvation Army, and I started doing that stuff, and I just, it's the best thing that I do. It's kind of like nothing fills me more than doing that. And what an opportunity, what a blessing to be able to do that. And I found that, I guess, talk about recovery. I didn't talk about my amends. Not going to get into that, but sixth and seventh step became very prominent in my life. My friend Martin, I think I saw him on the screen here. We bought that book, Drop the Rock. We spent about a year reading it, there's a lot of things I didn't identify in that book, but there's a lot of things I did. The idea of looking at your own behavior, I can't fix me, I can't change me, but I need changing. And am I willing to change? Yeah, I'm willing to change. And I need God's help with all of it. The idea of it used to be, the world is hard. You have a rough day at work and people pissing you off and life is hard, and you come home and it's okay to be a jerk because it's home. She's got to take it because she lives here, and I can be an asshole. And no, I can't. The answer is no, I can't. I can't get away with that for myself. I couldn't, just checking up on my behavior. I remember at the university men's, when I used to go there, I'd say, "How you doing? How's your recovery?" And some old timer in the kitchen would say, "You want to find out how his recovery is? Ask his wife, ask his kids, ask his boss, see how he's doing in life." And that's the challenge these days, is to behave in a way that I approve of my own behavior, that I know that kind of the way God wants me to be is how I'm going to be. I'll never forget, we talk about speakers. I'm always quoting speakers. I remember hearing a speaker who said, do you want to keep defending the guy that you are, or you want to become the man that you were meant to be?" I said, that's a challenge and a half. Yeah, I think I'd like to become the man I want to be. And staying close to Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that works for me, and it works wonderfully. I mean, we all say it sometimes, but it's true for me, and it's true for a lot of us. I'm a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need this more. I need this as much today as I ever did, and I love it as much as I ever did. And I'm grateful to my core for all you guys and for my recovery in AA. So, thanks a lot. Thanks for listening. Glad to be here.